Hello, and welcome to Somerset Lost and Found, in which we dig into the history and folklore of the county. Today, Alfred the Great. What did he ever do for Somerset? Was he really that great? And where is Wessex, anyway? To help me answer these and other questions, it's my great pleasure to introduce our guest, Dan Broadbent. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here, thanks.
Now, Dan, I'll let you introduce yourself, as you've got what is politely called a portfolio career, and I'd probably take about 20 minutes to get through it, so feel free to give yourself a bit of a plug.
So I am an archaeologist by training, worked as a field archaeologist for many years, and then worked in museums. So I was manager of the Museum of Somerset in Taunton. I was there for 7 years, I think. And then more recently, I've been working on the Quantock Hills, running community archaeology projects and community heritage work. The other string to my bow is storytelling, which has been born out of the heritage and the archaeology, really, and a real fascination, particularly with local folklore and myths and legends. So this sounds like my sweet spot. That combination of history and folklore is really where I enjoy exploring. You know?
Sure, and I suppose actually before we start digging in, that makes me think that you, how do you, as someone in your position, distinguish when we're looking at, say, the life of Alfred the Great between what is folklore, you know, the burning of the cakes, etc., sure, and what is historical fact? I mean, what do you have? I don't know if it's an archaeological question or a history question.
It is archaeology, and obviously documentary sources are the key one. When you're dealing with someone like Alfred in particular, it's interesting because we have really good documentary sources for Alfred. I think he's said to be kind of like the best documented English king, I think, before Elizabeth or Henry VIII, for example.
Really? Okay.
Because we have things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is a really detailed sort of year-by-year record of what was happening during the Anglo-Saxon period. We have a very detailed biography of King Alfred written at the time by his friend Bishop Asser. And there's various others as well. There's Alfred's own writings as well and his own translation work. But there's a slight caveat, because all of those sources were either written by or commissioned by Alfred himself.
So there's, okay,
so there's an inherent...
Yes, otherwise known as Alfred the Great. Yes.
Although, I mean, but then that name didn't become attached until much later.
Right.
But he's very well documented, so you've got this fantastic historic record, but you do have to take that with a pinch of salt, and with that come these sort of folkloric legendary stories as well, and unpicking them is often really, really tricky, and sometimes it's a case of judgment, you know, looking at the bigger picture of essentially just analysing what's most likely to be true. In Alfred's case... we've got a lot to work with, put it that way.
Well, it sounds like it actually. And I do have another question, because your mention of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle reminded me of... Now, I have to be careful not to take up the whole podcast with a bit of context before we start on Alfred. But yeah. You had... Now, the Anglo-Saxons, clearly a phrase, I guess, if they're calling something the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. But they were originally separate people, weren't they? The Angles and the Saxons.
Absolutely.
And indeed,
yes.
Angleland, or England... Yes. Is apparently named after one of them. But we tend to hear more about the Anglo-Saxons. What was going on there?
This is true. So the sort of broad context then, obviously, is the Roman legions depart from around 410 AD onwards, and then you have essentially two centuries, or a little bit, in Somerset, a little bit more than two centuries, which we, you know, historians traditionally call the Dark Ages, and some people now don't like using that term. But I think it's a very apt term to describe a period that we still know relatively little about. And actually what's happening in terms of the emergence of different kingdoms is still really hazy in that couple of centuries, up until sort of the 7th century. But what appears to be happening is there's a void, essentially. There's a void in terms of administration and government, which is filled by various incoming tribes from across the North Sea, particularly from what is now Denmark and Northern Germany. And so, we've got the Saxons, the Angles. So the Angles mostly settle in what is now East Anglia. Saxons settling in what is now Essex, the East Saxons, Sussex, Wessex, Kingdom of the West Saxons. you have the Jutes coming across, who do seem to kind of just get amalgamated into them, and we sort of lose them a little bit. There are people who are much more versed in the minutiae of where the different tribes settled than I. But yes, over that sort of period of a few hundred years, things broadly settle into a picture where you have, as I say, East Anglia, you have Kent, you have the area called Sussex, and then you have Wessex, which I think, as someone who's lived half my life in Somerset, I feel like Somerset has almost claimed the term Wessex, you know. Not least in that we've kind of appropriated the Wessex flag for the Somerset flag. That's one example of that.
Okay, right.
But originally, that kingdom stretched a lot further. So it stretched right down to the border with Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And then right the way across country, well into Hampshire, beyond Reading, and covering sort of Wiltshire and much of Dorset, etc. as well. So it's a really huge area that we're talking about.
And it's just a last word on the Angles. So the East Anglian, of course, the counties Norfolk and Suffolk are North Folk.
That's
and
right,
South
yes,
Folk.
Yes, exactly right.
And you have, as you identified, the East Saxons, Essex, the South Saxons, Sussex. Well, Wessex didn't survive as a name. Was that because it was so much huger than the others?
That's a good question. I'm not completely sure of the answer of that, but I suspect it is largely to do with that. You know,
Sorry, while you're thinking, Dan, yeah. I also think the actual shape and size of Wessex was sort of in flux for a lot of this period.
Absolutely, yes. Very, very sort of flexible. And that's one of the things, if we're talking about Alfred and particularly his relation to Somerset, for example, is these kind of fixed geographical borders just didn't really exist at that time. So the concept of the shires, so you've got Somerset Shire, Dorset Shire, etc., these are starting to emerge perhaps towards the end of Alfred's reign, but they don't become in any way formalised until well into the 10th century. And really not that long before the Norman Conquest. So that's when you get Wessex kind of dividing up into these more fixed administrative areas, effectively.
Yes.
But prior to that, I think the concept of Somerset or Dorset, these counties, you had... So Somerset kind of comes from the people who were focused on Somerton. You know, that seems to be, which was a kind of royal court was established at Somerton. Royal in terms of the House of Wessex. But there are lots of other kind of areas within the Wessex area as well. So it's a very slow period of these borders moving and becoming fixed because it's a period of incredible flux. Because effectively, from the Romans leaving, you have pretty much constant warfare for several hundred years and territory being claimed and reclaimed and moving around. So that's a very sort of woolly answer.
I think we get the picture. And again, without wanting to go into a whole other podcast, you've got the Vikings presumably coming
exactly
in. Roughly when would they have sort of started?
So invading? The traditional date for the Vikings first appearing is when they raid Lindisfarne, which is 793, I think, right at the end of the 8th century. There are actually earlier raids than that, but that's the one which is such a big deal because they're attacking such a kind of sacred and important site, but everybody's attention is drawn to that. So that's when they officially arrive in Britain.
Yeah. That's fine. So, but that means, I suppose, we've got about 200 or 300 years of not being invaded once the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes have come.
Exactly.
And so in what was Wessex, did the Anglo-Saxons establish kings of each region? Well, how did it work? So what was Alfred born into in terms of a dynasty?
So they did establish kings of each region. There's definitely a sort of royal household of Wessex and the other Saxon areas. But it's not as straightforward as being born into a dynasty. I think I'm right in saying that Alfred is the first in quite some time, and I can't think of the exact number of years, but he's the first in quite a while to actually succeed his father.
Right.
Because whenever a king dies, there's a void, and there is a battle to sort of succeed. So Alfred was one of the relative few at that point to actually succeed and take a hereditary title in the way.
Having to fight for
exactly.
it. Okay. And so what was the span of his control at the point at which he became king?
Well, it was the full extent of Wessex. So at that point, again, there's very sort of rough borders down to, from Cornwall, really just to the outskirts of London, really. And then going north, obviously covering Wiltshire. There's a constant... The real threat in the early part of Alfred's reign is with Mercia. So that's the big kingdom, which covers, essentially the Midlands now. So his initial threat is not the Vikings. It's establishing control of that border with Mercia, really.
Right, yes. And in terms of... To the extent that we can isolate Somerset within Wessex, what would our typical, Somerset dweller have known about what was going on? Would there have been a lot of effect on their daily lives from Alfred as a king?
I mean, that is a question which is still heavily debated by historians about what actually the impact of change at the top would have on people down at the bottom. And I suspect the answer is really not that much. Not that much until it comes to a point where their own livelihoods are under threat, which is certainly what happened a little while into Alfred's reign, when the Vikings really start to impinge on Wessex. And so what happens there is... So Alfred comes to the throne around 870. He's still a really young man. He's only in his early 20s. And he spends most of that early point of his, as I say, fighting off, establishing that border with Mercia, but also dealing with sort of Viking raids. Because the Vikings have, by that point, they've come across and they have taken control of much of the sort of eastern part of the country. And they too are attacking Mercia. And there comes a point around 877, 878, where Wessex is pretty much alone. But almost, kind of like the last one standing. And it's in 878, in January 878, that Alfred is celebrating Christmas. And on Twelfth Night, he's in Chippenham with his court and the Vikings. Despite having recently agreed a kind of peace deal with him and being paid off to sort of move back and exchange hostages from previous battles, despite all of that, on Twelfth Night, or thereabouts, the Vikings attack Chippenham, where the royal court is, and there is a slaughter. They overrun the place, and many of Alfred's retinue are killed. But Alfred and a very small band, it seems, of other close associates are able to flee, and that's when they flee into the Somerset Marshes and to Athelney, which is where the legendary Alfred kind of emerges from.
Okay, so the... It's a bit like, it reminds me of the Red Wedding in Game of Thrones. It's all very TV friendly.
It's all very Game of Thrones. I mean, and Tolkien as well. They're all heavily influenced by this period.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. So he retreats into the Somerset Levels, which, let's have a quick aside on the Somerset Levels. Mm. Were they as we would know them now?
No. So they are. They are effectively wetland, marshland. The descriptions, contemporary descriptions, are that people can only get about using punts for those kind of boats, which is, I think, the key thing. So essentially, what's happening is the Vikings are overrunning most of the country, and they probably feel like, even though Alfred has escaped the raid on Chippenham, they probably feel that it's only a matter of time until he's caught and killed and they are in full control of the country. But I think it's key that he retreats into the marshlands, because the Vikings can't penetrate there. Famously, the Viking longships are very shallow draft, so they can penetrate up rivers and into more inland areas. The ships can't penetrate the levels, and for a vast army, which is what the Vikings have at that time, you know, they can't, again, in vast numbers, they can't penetrate, but with a small group of people who know the area as well, Alfred is able to kind of navigate his way to Athelney. So the levels are marshland, wetland, with these slightly raised areas, which are called birtles or islands. And at Athelney, there was a pre-existing fortified site, an Iron Age hill fort, and he's able to kind of establish himself with some degree of security there and can just begin to take stock and plan a next move.
I mean, it's a pretty... Sorry, I was going to say it's a pretty Spartan existence, presumably, but then I don't suppose anyone's existence at that time was particularly luxurious.
I think for someone coming from Alfred's position, it would have been, you know, being a king of Wessex would have been fairly luxurious, you know, for the time. So it would certainly have been a big change in his circumstances, yes, at the very least. Now, obviously, this is where the very famous story of him burning the cakes comes from.
Oh, okay.
So as he retreats into Athelney, he and again, it's unclear exactly what kind of retinue he has with him, but presumably it's a small number. But they take refuge in the cottage of a swineherd, according to the tradition. And whilst the swineherd is out about his work and his wife is out busy doing her work, Alfred is tasked with looking after these little bread cakes that are cooking gently on the hearth. And of course, obviously, he's so engrossed in his own thoughts and thinking about his kingdom and what's going to happen next that he allows the cakes to burn. So that story comes directly from Athelney.
But and maybe you're uniquely qualified to answer this as a professional storyteller. Isn't it interesting? Why would that story become so embedded it's in history that kind of every... I had a Ladybird book, which that was basically told me.
Absolutely.
About Alfred the Great was that he burned some cakes.
I think you're right. I think if anyone knows anything about Alfred, it's that he burnt the cakes, right?
Yes.
It is a really interesting one. So there are other little bits of folklore that come out of that period as well. But the cakes does stick. And I think it's quite early. So the first record of it is, I think in the 10th, certainly by the 11th century, it's in existence. So it's relatively early, which suggests perhaps there is an element of truth in it. Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's impossible to know if there's any truth in it. But something about it sticks. But it does play in, obviously, to this idea of a king who is at his wit's end. He's, you know, really staring down the barrel, as it were. But he's still utterly focused on what his next move is. So I guess, you know, it plays very much into the whole cult of Alfred, which kind of develops later.
Yes.
And ends up with him being given the moniker of being the Great.
And maybe reassuring to peasants that, you know, they can do things a king can't.
Perhaps so as well. I suppose it really humanises him, doesn't it? Of course, it brings him down to their level and makes him... Yeah, I guess makes this king who is... He absolutely believed that he was sort of anointed by God. But it makes him much, much more human.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So he's hiding out in the Somerset Levels. And what kind of time period are we talking about here? Is he biding his time for quite a while?
No, it's not. It's not that long. It's really only, I think, a matter of months. He's able to somehow, and this is an interesting thing, because the traditional picture is that, as I say, he's at his wit's end, he's only got a small retinue of people with him, and there's this idea that he's fighting a guerrilla war against the Vikings. I'm not sure how much truth there is in that. There is still a substantial network of eldermen from the western part of Wessex, so further west into Somerset, who he is able to draw upon. And so within a matter of months, he's gathering, he's able to send word out and get to the people of Somerset, which I think, so this is from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and I think that is the first use of the word Somerset, all the people of Somerset.
Oh, okay.
As well as Dorset and Wiltshire, to meet at the meeting place at Egbert Stone, From where they then are able to push forward to Edington, where famously there is the great battle at which he does finally, not fully defeat, but certainly push back the Viking incursion into Wessex.
Right, and Egbert Stone, you say, is that an actual stone, and is it still there?
There is, I believe, an actual stone. No, actually, no. No, I'm thinking of different stones. No, because the exact precise location of Egbert Stone is not known.
Ah, okay.
But it's the most likely is on the borders of Somerset and Wiltshire and Dorset, one of those meeting. So,
right.
So here, more locally, on the Quantox, we have Triscombe Stone, for example. So that's another sort of stone meeting point, which is at the border of of three different parishes in that case. So these kind of meeting stones were quite well known. So okay. A relatively easy place for people to be directed.
Yes, and if you got a message out saying, this is where we'll meet, and presumably, if it had fallen into the hands of the Vikings, they wouldn't have known where it was. So
Potentially.
Okay. So he then gets a battle with his army that he's assembled, pushes the Vikings back, and then does he move on? Does he get out of the levels at that point?
He does, yeah. So at that point, ultimately he's establishing himself at Winchester, which is where, in the view of a great sort of place, which is heavily associated with Alfred. So this is the thing about his relationship with Somerset. I don't think that he is... The idea of Somerset is really in his consciousness at this point. He is much more focused on the entirety of Wessex and indeed in expanding Wessex. And according to tradition, so there's another bit of folklore that emerges out of this, which is that while he was in Athelney, he has a vision of St Cuthbert, who advises him on how to defeat the Vikings, but also plants the seed of the idea of a united England.
Right.
Or at least a uniting the English peoples against the Vikings. And that seems to become his focus. So he does return to Somerset immediately following Eddington, because Guthrum, who is the leader of this great summer army, as it's called, of the Vikings, and several of his sort of key followers, are brought back to the levels, and they are baptised as Christians at the Church of Allah, which is the nearest church to Athelney. So presumably the church that Alfred would have been using while he was there. And then Alfred goes on to establish an abbey at Athelney as well. So it's certainly that particular part of Somerset. I think Alfred is very, very aware of the significance that it's played in it. So it's clearly important to him at that point. But in terms of this broader picture of Somerset, I don't think that's in his consciousness. He is pushing out and concerned with keeping the Vikings at bay at that point.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so I suppose if we're being kind to him, in terms of what he did for Somerset, he's actually putting it on the map along with the rest of Wessex. If you were in Somerset, you're part of something pretty significant, so which is Alfred's kingdom.
You could probably argue that it's the stirrings of an idea of a Somerset identity. You could probably argue that.
I was just going to ask, in my usual fashion, whether Athelney or any of these places, for people who want to go and visit at the weekend, anything still there? Anything you could find?
At Athelney, there is a monument at Athelney. It is on farmland, but I believe there is sort of permissive access to go and see the monument. There was an episode of Time Team a long time ago, which did the most significant archaeology of a site, and they did find evidence of a cemetery and the sort of stone-built monastery which Alfred established there. And I think actually that was when they established that there had been a pre-existing Iron Age settlement there as well. So there's not a huge amount to see other than the monument, but it's an interesting because you've got... from there, you can start to imagine the wetlands and how it would have appeared, slightly raised. And then what you also have is... you've got East Lyng, or just Lyng as it was, which was another kind of important settlement in that period, and there was at some point a causeway between Athelney and Lyng. And Ling is significant as well, because what Alfred did do next after Edington, and famously as a means of defending against further Viking attacks and incursions, was establish what are called burhs, which are these defended towns. So some of these were existing towns which were fortified, some of them were newly established. But the idea, broadly speaking, was that no person within Wessex should be within more than a day's march from one of these defended settlements.
Okay, right.
And within the settlements you would have the market. Some of them, some of the burhs have been shown to have mints in, so minting coins. And I think this is all part of Alfred's understanding of how the Vikings waged war. So they were raiders, you know, they were opportunists. So the attack on Chippenham, for example, they knew that that was a time when the royal court was likely to be vulnerable because it was a Christian festival. So there's often sort of opportunistic attacks like that. What they were terrible at was siege warfare.
Right.
So by creating a defended settlement that everyone could retreat into, that had the markets that made money and also the mints, etc., they were much more much better defended against what the Vikings could offer in terms of attack.
Right. Okay, and I'm sorry to do this again. Yeah. Any of those that that survive in kind of Somerset names or places?
Well,
or...
so I mean the best. Well, maybe the best in terms of it's hard to access now. You've got Dawes Castle at Watchet. So Watchet was one. So Dawes Castle, again, was a pre-existing Iron Age hill fort. So it had defences already. But then that was converted into a burh, which did have its own royal mint there as well. So there's still substantial earthworks there. But because that is now eroding into the cliff, I'm not sure what sort of public access is like at there now.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, but you've got Watchet, you've got Ling, as I said, and Langport as well, with burhs as well.
Right.
There's not a huge amount, I don't think, that you can see. Some of them, maybe a few earthworks if you've got the eye for it.
Yes.
But generally speaking, you know, there's not a huge amount.
It's always tricky, isn't it? Go anything before the Norman conquest just seems to be very elusive.
But if you've got an eye for reading sort of medieval street plans, for example, which are often quite uniform, you know, quite regular, then you can kind of see that somewhere like Langport, for example. You can kind of see that sort of medieval core.
Okay. Now, the time's starting to tick away, so I just wanted to ask you, this was probably all in your head, Dan, if anything in terms of the general sort of theme of Alfred's greatness and Somerset's kind of benefiting from him, is there anything we haven't discussed that you think it's worth mentioning?
Well, yeah, so, we've talked about his sort of military prowess, I guess, which actually is sometimes questioned, because in the early part of his reign... He is, as I say, just fending off, and he's also paying off the Vikings, which more often than not doesn't work, because soon enough they're back. There does seem to be this turning point at Athelney. It's really not hyperbole, I don't think, to say that if he hadn't retreated into Athelney, into the Somerset Marches, and been able to regroup and regather his forces, and if the Vikings had taken control, then the idea of England wouldn't have existed.
Right.
They wouldn't, and probably the English language, as we know today, wouldn't exist.
Okay.
And from there, you can make a pretty rational case, I think. I don't think it is hyperbole to say that it does change the course of world history. The English language wouldn't have spread over the world with the British Empire, which itself might not have happened. So it really is a key turning point in history.
Wow.
So that's one thing.
Yes, that's pretty significant. Yes, okay.
The other thing in terms of his greatness, so nowadays I think most scholars would alight on what happens, again, post-Athelney and post-Eddington, not just with the creation of the burhs, which sort of establishes the concept of the townships that we still live in Britain, or in England certainly. That's kind of urban kind of life, which had completely gone after the Roman period. But the other thing is his programme of learning and literature. So much of this, I think, was driven by his kind of devout spirituality and his Christian faith. But he also, I think, understood that it was important that people were able to understand, at the very least, the law, the new laws that he was also creating. So he undertook his programme of translation of sort of key spiritual texts, so the Psalms, for example, and various other sort of key pieces of literature current at that time, which he viewed were essential for people to understand, and they were translated into the sort of vernacular English of the time rather than from the Latin. And I think that is really now recognised as one of his key achievements. There's this sense that there had been a fairly well established, certainly sort of a network of theological schools, at least, established in various monasteries, etc., which was really, really damaged by the Viking raids, and the one at Lindisfarne is a key example. So Alfred himself was illiterate until well into middle age, largely as a result of the fact that that network of education had been taken away. So re-establishing that is another of the key key factors in why he did he was given this name of being Alfred the Great.
Yes. Well, and I have to say, I think the view of this podcast is he was great.
I would think
he did a few good things. That's brilliant. Dan, thank you so much. We'll be getting you back on the podcast to talk about something else in due course. But thanks ever so much for illuminating us on Alfred.
My pleasure. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. See you next time.